So I'm going to open the floor to comments on the questions that have been raised.
The people, by the way, when you speak for the first time, identify yourself. And, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I should also mention, yeah, please identify yourself, and I will also be privileging people who haven't spoken as the conversation progresses. So.
Yeah, my name is Jalal Hussain. I'm originally from Pakistan. And I remember a BBC interview in which a lady from Peshawar was talking. She was like, she said she's 18 years old and she has about 4 kids and she is in the business of prostitution. Because her excuse was that my husband has died in the war and I have nothing to fend these children. How can I sustain them? So now I'm in this prostitution and I get a little money so I can. So what I'm saying is women and prostitution has become a very natural corollary of this war in Afghanistan. Then it is attached to this the whole thing of class. Somehow I cannot think anything else when there's a class situation which we have not talked about. There's an elite group of 2% and there's a non-elite group of 98%. So whenever we discuss something about women or anything, we have to talk about the class buildup of society, whether it's in Pakistan or it's in UK. What do you think about it?
Well, I can't believe that I didn't mention prostitution. Since my most recent book is, non-fiction book anyway, is about sex tourism to Thailand. And the Thai sex industry in its present form is a product of the Vietnam War. The U.S. Not only had military bases, Air Force bases in Thailand, but had signed contracts to rotate men in from the front to Thailand as one of the places for what is called R&R, rest and recreation, which in the grunts on the field called I&I for intercourse and intoxication. In 1971, as the Vietnam War was still raging, people high up in the Thai government asked the World Bank, which was whose president was visiting with a task force, what's going to happen to our economy when the foreign troops leave? And they established a committee which recommended, and a World Bank recommendation means we'll lend you money for this and for no other economic initiative, recommended that they develop mass tourism, which they did. Tourism by the mid-80s became the single largest source of foreign exchange. And mass tourism there is based on the continuation of the prostitution that flourished during the Vietnam War period. And the head of the World Bank at that time was Robert McNamara, who had been the U.S. Secretary of Defense at the time that the R&R contracts were signed. If any individual in the world knew what tourism would mean in Thailand, it was Robert McNamara. The result has been the creation of an industry that provides jobs for women. It has been the national participation in the international planning process that ended up this way with the tourism was to further impoverish the poor areas of the country so that families had no choice but to send at least one daughter to Bangkok or to the resorts, etc. This is very typical. Thailand is unique in certain ways, but the relationship of war to creating jobs for women in one sector as civil society is destroyed in another sector, so that other kinds of jobs are not available, jobs in the sex industry is well known. The idea is that the male fighter is entitled to sexual release, whether that is through rape of conquered women, through creation of red light districts, through these organized rest and recreation periods, through camp followers in the older days, but that is part of his entitlement along, because he is going out to risk his life. Anyway, but it is absolutely true that and that of course this is a class situation, that matches the upper class women going with their maids to go work to drive ambulances for the poor boys.
Would you like to comment on that?
No, but I completely agree with what Lily was saying. I don't have anything more to add.
Okay. There's a number of hands going up. And just to remind people that this is very much an action-oriented and strategizing conference, and so the more we can speak about some of the questions about women's participation in a peace process, in an anti-imperialist movement, the more we'll be sort of pushing along those lines.
My question is actually just about what you were talking about earlier. I'm sorry, my name is Leisha, and it's, my question is for Rodi. You had mentioned that women's involvement in the military wasn't making any changes, but I'm just wondering how women's, maybe not the American military, because I think that women's role in the American military is different than in some of the other countries, but are they affecting change on the way that the rest of relaxation is interacting with prostitution? Like, how, because surely that the chiefs or generals or whoever organizes these periods and brings in prostitutes for the men might be challenged on that a little bit by the female officers.
Not as far as I have ever heard. Absolutely. And it's you know, because the rest and recreation is not officially for prostitution. It's officially to get men out of the battlefront. They get to, you know, sleep longer hours. They get nicer food. They, you know, they get to go to entertainment of all sorts. And during Vietnam, they had a choice of places to go. There were 8 places, and there would be several on the list for the weeks that you were going. You checked off. Thailand was if you definitely wanted, you know, to have nothing but sex. But you could go to Hawaii, which was actually in the United States, and so some guys would be met by their wives in Hawaii. A Vietnam vet friend of mine had a fellow soldier who went to Hawaii so he could catch a plane to California and plant his marijuana seeds that he'd picked up in Vietnam, so he could start a business when he got home. He would have flourishing little agro business there, a very exceptionally good, high class, you know, marijuana. But
right.
So anyway,
she knows.
But anyway, the I have never heard of the women objecting to what the men, you know, are doing on their leaves. The one thing I remember was that the U.S. sent women troops in large numbers to the Gulf during the Gulf War, and personal experiences in quotes in the letter section of Penthouse for the next year or two were full of letters from guys talking about their experiences with women soldiers, American women soldiers, that, you know, there they are, you know, basically fucking up rabbits in the, you know, in a society that is otherwise very repressive, where the guys are not going to find prostitutes easily. But that they had the women soldiers, who were also understood to be very horny and, you know, out there frustrated, and that was, so there were all these, there's a section of Penthouse called The Forum, in which people write in their sexual experiences, and that's what they were writing. But that's the only, so there may be less of it. I asked a specialist on Israeli society, who has written a book called Kibbutz Diary, about whether young men and women raised on the same kibbutz tend to marry each other. And she said, oh, never, it's practically incest, you know, to do that, because they're raised, particularly when they were raised in the children's houses separately, but even now, when they're raised more in their families, you don't marry within the same kibbutz. And she said, in fact, Ari service is a way of meeting. You know, it's like a dating service. You know, meet people from other parts of the country, et cetera. And because there are more equal numbers in that military than in other militaries, obviously a lot of that goes on. But I don't think that women officers have reached a point where they would have that kind of influence in the military. And I'm not sure that they would have the mentality to consider it an inappropriate behavior.
I just wanted to give you an example of what happened to one of the women in the military here, where she was undergoing training, and I don't know if people remember the story, that she was tied to a tree during training, and she actually then launched a case against this particular treatment, but she was the exception, because all the other women had accepted that particular kind of training, the brutalizing way in which training is undertaken. So it is a question of just by there being more women in the military does not mean that you are going to be able to change the culture. There's a point which Lillian made earlier in her presentation, and that was that the participation of women in the military in some ways is a way for them to get out, and it is a non-traditional role for them. It's very much what happened to blacks in the US, for whom joining the army was a way of getting out of a circle of poverty and of really acquiring some kind of a sense of a personhood, because every other aspect of their life they really had no way in which they could feel that they were worthwhile citizens, that the joining the army gave them that particular sense, because there was order, there was all of those kind of things. The uniform gave a lot of power to these young men. But it's the same with women who are able to go and join the military, that they also acquire a kind of aura around them that they're a little bit better than other people. And that is the mentality of militarism, that you develop a new culture of militarism.
But there's also, that those are sort of the psychological benefits, but the literal benefits. It's a class thing in that for many young people, it's the way of getting access to training, to job training. You get an income while you're doing it. You get a roof over your head and three meals a day. And the guys I knew who, older men in my family, for instance, who served in World War II, who came from working class backgrounds where we had enough food on the table, talked about meeting men in the military who were getting, everybody, bitches about military food, getting the best food of their lives because there was enough and it was good, well-balanced meals, the first time they ever had that in their lives. And this is when you see who the military are in the repressive regimes in the Third World. These are guys from very low segments of the society who are not only getting a gun to put in their hands to tyrannize over other people, but they're getting three meals a day and a roof over their head.
There's two comments, one here and one person.
Yeah, and I have a question each for both. That's fine. Lillian, in places like Colombia, the fact that the armed revolutionary forces of Colombia has 30% of its 30% of that organization literally are women. And it's not just about escaping poverty, but one of the reasons they join voluntarily is to escape abuses of war, the brutality, for example, of the Colombian army, and the brutality of right-wing by paramilitaries. War became a mechanism for self-defense. It's just like the way a woman will carry a gun in the streets of New York. And also, in Africa now, we see a new pattern in which rebel movements are conscripting women into rebel movements, and especially teenagers in Sierra Leone, in Uganda, and it's a growing menace. So what will you say to that? And for Shire, and you talk about absence of women in peace, in the peace process, and we know that one of the most important aspects of the peace process is demilitarization. Can you just say a little bit more about role of women in demilitarization?
Well, I think Sri made the distinction between women in resistance and women in the official military. But in the 60s, there was a time when we romanticized the role of women in the resistance movements also. And we have come to see, as certain resistance movements have taken state power, that it does not make a change. You would think any place where women had guns in their hand, where they put them down, it would make a difference. And it doesn't necessarily. But if women picked up a gun after through understanding what it is that the existing power structure does to women. That's another matter. I'm not saying that that's excluded, but and when you say conscripting into rebel movements, it's like the child soldiers.
Yeah.
You know, people who have no, you know, so some of these child soldiers are now girl soldiers. Mm. That, you know, that's just as unacceptable, whether, you know, whichever gender it is.
Yeah, and especially there is no awareness growing in the West that's happening.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, in 67, whatever it was, I think watching the Battle of Algiers and seeing, you know, the film, you know, and seeing the women from an oppressed culture come to consciousness and come to participation in movement, including, you know, in this, you know, scene where the woman is the one who places the bomb because she can get through, you know, the French, guards, you know, checkpoints more easily. We've seen what happened in Algeria, that the reassertion of nationalism meant a reassertion of male power and the most traditional roles for women. It's not enough. And some people, I'm sure in this audience, will say not only is it not enough, but it shouldn't happen altogether.
To respond to the question that you posed me, I mean, I really don't have any answers because it's very clear that women have participated in resistance movements. I mean, if you look at whether they are old ones or they are new ones, but the moment it comes to the point where there are negotiations, that is when they are actually pushed out of the whole picture. And even if you look at the Second World War, where women's participation was extremely high in terms of really whether it was building bombs or, you know, driving trucks, any of those. But the moment the war ended, they were asked to go home and make babies, that it was that was the suitable roles for them. And what was interesting is that they actually bought into that particular vision of what was happening. So just being a woman does not automatically mean that you are going to be free of the values that you are constantly exposed to and brought up with. I think that what Lillian was saying about, you know, glorification of war, glorification of militarism for nationhood. I mean, I can tell you stories from Indian history where women used to in ceremonies would tell their husbands, tell their brothers that they would rather see them dead than to come back without having won the war. Rajasthan, this was a big glorification of this tradition where the women would then close themselves off and burn themselves because they did not want to be taken as victims, or rather as trophies in a war. So this is all of that to say that really having those kind of traditions only means that patriarchy is so strong that a lot more has to be done than we have been able to do so far in terms of breaking that down. And also to be very conscious in terms of taking a very active role. That is, if we have, and there should be a very strong voice out there, and that women are taking over. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Palestine, Israeli women and Palestinian women are speaking out on this issue. But how to make their way to the peace table, that is much more difficult.
Can I just follow that very briefly, because it's
sure.
In reference to that, the United Nations Resolution 1325 of October 2000 makes a little headway there, and the first article is that member states to ensure increased representation of women at all decision-making levels in national, regional, and international institutions and mechanisms for the prevention, management, and resolution of conflict. We have to really hammer that home to our governments as much as we can, make it a reality, but it's about time.
I was passing the exam, Marcia.
If we have a little preamble here, I gotta tell you, most people don't like my style, so you'll just have to forgive me. Even my friends don't like my style. So Sri, we started off here promoting peace and taking action. Now, for me, taking action, there's nothing like taking action, because what we've been doing here is we're having these conferences over and over and over again. It's the same issue. We play around, we pickle around, we use another word, we use this word, and we change the terminology and everything else. But what we haven't really talked about is the actual action. How are we going to make these changes besides sitting here and talking at a conference, which I've been to conferences for I don't know how many years, well, 15 some odd years, and it started with Voice of Women. We got three of us here that were in Voice, so you know we've been talking for an extremely long time. What we haven't been focusing on is the actual action of what we're doing to make the positive changes. And since I figure I've been studying the action part of it, because the academia is really turning me off, because I'll tell you something, Lillian, Women Against Imperialism, it can happen with a few people, yeah, but it'll never be a great big movement. And I think the world is getting so bad these days that we have to really look at the actions that we're taking and get rid of the academia. So what do we have today? We have demonstrations where people are getting violent. Everything is being focused on the violence. There's anti-globalization. There's women in the military. There's the environment. There's this. There's that. And what you're doing is you're overkilling the general population with all the damn problems and not coming into some type of solution with the activism itself. It's just an overkill, absolute overkill. But what can we do to make the changes? I mean, Sri knows, and I've hassled you for a long time, and Rosemary and Barbie are here. You know, it's participation within the democratic political process. If you want to make the changes that we're all talking about that needs to be made, you better learn how your government works, how a political party works. Because especially with women within the political process, you get the double dip. It's just a gold mine there, and we're not learning about that. We're not learning about actually what to do. We're only looking at the academia. And if anybody ever wants to debate whatever it is, how it works, let me know, because it can't be debated. It's a practical thing. That's the only true, I would suppose, political science there is. And we don't participate. I'll leave it open. If anybody wants to talk about it, let her rip.
That was a very provocative comment. There's a number of people on
the speaker. Yes, it is.
No, I'm just saying, I know a lot of people want to respond to it, but we also have a speakers list. So I'm going to continue with that speakers list, I think, but I want people to be able to respond to that question also, so I'll continue taking a speaker's list and you can facilitate your own response. The next person is you.
Sana.
And then there is right in the back
here. No. She said that Roxana was first and then you.
Well, I was going to say something, but this question is my name is Rosanna Barantesha from Simone de Beauvoir Institute. My question was that in terms of action, I'm thinking that should the feminists be against the military? Or there's a lot of discussion about women having equal opportunity in the military. I'm just not sure where I stand. I was trained in the Islamist camp in Iran during the revolution, because there was a threat of coup by the Americans. So I received military training, and that was very empowering as a woman. I certainly didn't want to kill anybody with Kalashnikov.
You are the only person in the room a woman in the room who has learned to use a Kalashnikov.
And hand grenade.
And she could, you might take her course.
Yes, I hated that, but nonetheless, I thought that was very important, because if the Americans, there was another crew, I had to be able to defend. behind the country. So I'm just confused that this is a soul battle. Where do I stand? Do I stand against or do I stand? It's a question. I mean, it's more of a question. It's out loud thinking.
Since it is an open question, is there anybody who wants to respond briefly in 2 minutes with thoughts, or should I continue with the speaker's list?
Respond to what?
To what?
It's sort of the open question that Sana just posed.
Well, I thought, you know, I sort of answered that with relation to Algeria, and Iran is another good example. It was empowering to learn to use those weapons, but in fact, did that get women power in Iran?
No, it didn't. But do we stand for equal opportunity for women in the military, or do we fight against the military? Where do we stand in the context of North America?
I'm going to move on, and you can come back to these questions.
Yeah, my question. Kind of academic and also practical is if anyone in this room can offer some answer. It's why the human race changed from my understanding you say in America, not a tribal custom is the woman will make the decision. But what factors that lead to the change or to become a male dominant society? Maybe if we can have some answer in that factors, maybe we can look on that too.
We were having trouble either focusing or hearing or channeling information. Could you repeat the question?
My understanding is in America, a lot of Aboriginal tribes, their custom is the woman make the crucial decision of the tribe. And now the society changed to a male dominant society. If anyone in this room can offer some answer why that kind of change happened, if we can understand those factors, if we can look on this factor.
Why the shift of patriarchy is?
That's the something called the origins debate. In women's, you know, in women's studies, which we both have been teachers of, there are a number of theories about what happened. The one that based it on looking at North American Aborigines is Frederick Engels, Marx's collaborator, who speculated that it was the introduction of private property and the necessity, the perceived necessity, then to pass private property on through the male line that changed things. There are other theories, but in any case, it is a very long kind of argument about how we got here, and only certain part of. I advise everybody to take women's studies courses because that is one of the things we talk about. But in terms of our strategy now, the problem is here we are in that situation. And what do we do about it?
I wanted to. Marshall has now disappeared. No,
only for a cigarette.
She's taking action.
She's out of action, so we won't touch on that part of it. But what I originally wanted to talk about when we were talking about why women were absent from the peace process, and also how that ties into. Your question about why women are absent from the anti-imperialist movements. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think it's central to whether or not we will be able to bring forward change or not in our society. For me, the absence of women in those processes, and also the absence often of racialized persons from those processes go hand in hand. Is it that those two things go together? And for me, those are intimately tied to that there are certain moments where there's reconfiguring going on of power, where power is going to be held, who's going to hold power, and who ultimately will will speak for a group of people and who ultimately will take decisions for people. Women in resistance movements and women that have taken up arms in resistance movements, as far as I'm concerned, are just being used as another weapon. A woman's like a gun for a man. A woman holding a gun is just another weapon. It doesn't say anything about the status of women. But because for me, the ultimately, if it is something other than that, when there is a peace process, the women will be present. The women will be able to speak for themselves. People will be able to represent their own realities and themselves. And if women are not being used as weapons, then women will be present when power is being reconfigured. Women will be able to access power. Women will be able to access decision making. And this doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen in the mainstream way of things. And it doesn't happen within our anti-imperialist movements as well. I mean, I'm constantly shocked by the total lack of feminist analysis in all the documentation. I mean, we can take the papers off the tables here, and there's no analysis going on. There's no gender analysis. There's very, very little presence of any kind of a gender analysis in anything that's being produced. And for some reason, we are unable to break through those barriers. For me, even the question of us being affected, until we confront those things, until there is a sense of real inclusiveness within our movements, I personally don't think that we're going to achieve change. I keep working at it, that's why I'm still here, but it continues to discourage me. I mean, after 30 years, it still hasn't changed. And so I think that we need to bring that to our discussions tomorrow, which are shockingly short as well. Spending almost no time in a plenary for me is a means of controlling outputs of a conference. I'm shocked by the shortness of the discussions that we're going to be able to have tomorrow, which will limit the ability of women to be able to articulate their own platform around these issues. And as far as working within the system or outside of the system, I think those are personal choices. Some people can be effective working within the system, and some people can be more effective working outside of the system, and I think all those choices need to be respected, and that it is neither, one way is not better than another. I think there are different ways of doing that.
There's a number of people on the speakers list right now. You, whose name I don't know, I'm sorry, and then Harsha, you, Kai. I'm not sure if there's other responses, yeah. But just so that you know, I will get to you. And Roxanne, if you want to respond to
this. I agree with that, but I just think that it's very, the situation is far more complex. In you, by the very position that you're in, you're looking at the phenomena of an outsider. Women who take up arms do it for multiple reasons. Taking up arms, men that are gaining power vis-a-vis my violent husband at home. Taking up arms also meant that I was secure that there will never again be an American vision coming back to Iran, and that meant a great deal. It also meant that by keeping the Islamist government into power, we only had to fight with our local power, not with an American. So there was just one level that we had to fight. So if it happens, I will go through it again. I don't look at it as a mistake. I don't look at it as something. I wasn't a gun in the hand. I did that consciously aware of what I was doing. That I knew that fighting Americans was far more difficult than fighting Khomeini.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. It's not not saying what motivates women to do that. And I agree with everything you say as far as empowering women and all of that. But ultimately, the product of that is it for the men that are there next to you.
I disagree again, because the actual experience of Iran shows otherwise, that once Americans' hand was cut off from Iran, women are now highly in the position of that they're taking part, both as voters and political actors. So women have collectively gained political power vis-a-vis their men in the local context. I mean, there are examples. I mean, there are just different experiences in different parts of the world. But that is a part of the world that what we generally hold as truth is not true. What we think, we've seen it, we've seen example, when there's nationalist movement, women coming to, they take up arms, they fight, and then when the nationalist government takes over, then they're swept away. This has happened. This has not happened in Iraq.
I just want to add a little footnote. The other thing that you did that I know about was that after the Islamist Revolution, in addition to taking up arms, you taught, you as a university professor in Tehran, also taught basic literacy to women.
Mm-hmm.
At the mosque. You see,
at the mosque, I was teaching at the mosque, and during after the lunchtime prayer, and then after that there was military training. And then I just set up a daycare.
All of which empowers women.
I'd love to thank the panelists and everyone for their thoughtful comments. I have kind of a comment and then a question, because the way I've kind of been taught and then the way I've sort of come to analyze the situation is that whether it's women who have been put in to sex camps or forced prostitution, or whether it's third world women making computers for the military, like bringing pitted pennies, their exploitation of women seems to be global capitalist, predicated on the exploitation of women. It's not the byproduct of the operation of this planet to exploit women. It's actually, in order for the system to continue, women have to continue to be exploited. And so that being the case, I'm constantly come up with the question that was there any real gains for women, and then thereafter the rest of the people on the globe, any real gains can be made within this? These gains are always sort of talked about, reforms within the system that exists. And I think that's one of the questions that you brought up, whether women need to, the question of women taking arms within any particular struggle. It seems as though even in the Korean context, a lot of people who were in struggles against the Japanese or against the subsequent American imperialists, like, the question was, do we go for something statist? Do we create a nation? Or, I mean, I think these kinds of questions, the questions of what you fight for sort of configures what's going to happen afterwards. And that's like the core strategic question, what is it that we want? I guess my question, the initial question, I guess, is it possible in a capitalism, this kind of global economic system that we have now, for any kind of real change to occur? Because it seems that this global system is predicated on the exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's certainly a very important question that you raise, and one that contextualizes the discussion on militarism and really the theme of this particular conference. My own sense is that we really have to, when we look at the present system, we really need to look at it from the perspective of gender, race, and class, because without that you really cannot. Now your question is it possible, knowing what the reality is, can we actually change it? I think that if we don't have that hope of changing it, then it would be a very difficult life to live. So given the values that we believe in, and I'm assuming that we all share some common values, which is social justice, equality, social justice in the larger sense, not only in the sense of economic social justice, but really social, political, cultural, all of those kind of parameters. Having those values necessitates that we continue to build for a struggle that looks at how that system, and we begin to think that somehow the system is all powerful, but I think that this is why Marsha, who's not here, who decries the fact that there are academics who are doing all these studies, and yes, there are lots of academics who really do academic studies which don't go anywhere, but I think that you need tools to be able to make those kinds of connections, because without those tools, without being able to look at them, you really cannot develop some kind of a common program to begin to think of dismantling and taking down the house that has been built in support of the supremacy of some groups, some genders, genders, I don't know what to use in this context, but it's in the context of the discussion that we had just before the meeting today about genders. And so we really have to, we need to constantly work at that to be able to do something which is going to be, I don't know. Therefore, demonstrations, all of those actions, they help, but they may not be the answer. And of course, what Roxana was saying in terms of militarism and the power that women, that in fact, that it can be empowering to some women. But in the totality of things, you also would agree that it has a limited benefit, that it does not necessarily change the reality for vast numbers of women everywhere else. And that cannot be the solution, that all women should become part of the army in order to become empowered. Notwithstanding the fact that women do, in their individually, personally, that it brings about the change in their lives and their ability to negotiate their world around them.
Do you have a quick follow-up question?
Yeah, because what I was wondering is, because I think that without kind of, I think if you don't take it within the context of political economy, then you're faced with what happened in World War II, where a kind of figure like Rosie the Riveter could be seen as this true like feminist figure, and that, you know, women were empowering themselves, but they were making bombs that were going to go kill people all over the globe. So I think, and that's the kind of thing that I struggle with, is it, and I think people of color in this country, North America and in America, that had the same kind of issue when there was African American liberation struggle and liberation struggle for people of color in North America. It's whether, you know, do we work so that we can feed at the trough and give it some crumbs off the table, or do we go for something that's like a different system?
Well, unfortunately, those are not either or. You know, we have the primary responsibility of any revolutionary is to survive, so to make the revolution, and what you do between here and the revolution, and what the steps are is part of the problem. And women understand this particularly well, because all of the large scale social forces that we have to understand that affect women are indeed, you know, have a historical base, have a class base, have an international base. At the same time, we experience them one by one, woman by woman, and that is sometimes how we have to see what progress is. Marsha was saying that, you know, my idea of women in an anti-imperialist movement is not going to attract very many people. Well, and then last night, we talked a great deal through the keynote speakers about a mass movement rather than an activist-based movement. Well, the anti-imperialist movement is the only mass movement in the world. But from the point of view of relatively privileged people in North America, it doesn't look that way. In fact, the only way, you know, to see a mass movement is a movement against, you know, against imperialism. But what it is possible to acknowledge that there are gains within capitalism without therefore embracing capitalism and valorizing it. There are gains for some that often mean losses for another. The globalization of the economy, which is not new, but it's the present form of imperialism, makes that clear. But that those temporary gains can be used either for making changes or not for making changes. I wrote something once about an article I read where a woman, there was a problem in a neighborhood because there was a daycare in somebody's house, and the neighbors were complaining that at the time that the children were dropped off and picked up, there was too much traffic on the street. And a young woman who didn't even live on that street was very much involved in the campaign against the daycare, because she says, I do have empathy for children, but I also have empathy for real estate. Now, I would like to believe that a woman is a person who cannot, who does not believe it's possible to have empathy for real estate. This is what Karl Marx called, you know, the fetishism of commodities, that you can have a relationship with a thing, and the things can have relationships with each other. No, you can't do that. But it's not because it's inside us that we don't have empathy for real estate in general. It's because of our historical experience. And when women get certain privileges, some of them are going to have the same kind of fucked minds that people who have power, you know, the men who have power have. However, there are ways of using the prise that some women are going to have on society to make changes, to do the analysis, you know, as Sheree said, the academic analysis is part of that, to be freed to do that. And also to create counter-institutions that create models of how, of different ways of living.
Yeah, I just have a thought to share. I work with a peace collective within the peace movement in Toronto, and now they're promoting the concept of citizen diplomacy, which is a reaction to state diplomacy, which is controlled by state actors that are male-dominated, that exclude citizens, especially women. And what citizen diplomats will do is go into countries in which there is conflict, talk to parties to the conflict directly, engage in direct talks with rebel groups, engage in direct talks with government officials, submit proposals. And citizen diplomacy is a very powerful concept because no state interest is involved, no imperialist interest is involved. It's people-driven, and also it is very impartial. And actually, some governments, countries in which there is conflict, they have welcomed the concept of citizen diplomacy. Macedonia, for example, has welcomed citizen diplomats to come and participate in peacemaking and peacebuilding in Macedonia. And I think it is an avenue in which women can play a greater role to engage more effectively in citizen diplomacy, to challenge state diplomacy, in which states have monopolized the process of peacemaking and peacebuilding. Thank you.
Do either of you have a brief response to the comment?
Harsha was out of the room when her turn came.
Yeah,
did you have?
Okay.
So.
It's okay. Yeah. No, I mean, you are next. I just wondered if just to, you know, sound for it, but.
Just in response to what you said, no doubt that grassroots participation and the whole notion of having citizenships being exercised in this particular way, the difficulty seems to be to have them accepted as a legitimate voice of the people, because and that is where the biggest challenge is, that how do people have those voices heard and be taken seriously in terms of developing really a model for bringing about peace. I'm not sure how that works.
Some indication that many citizens in different parts of the world welcome citizen diplomats from outside. They see them as being impartial. Even if you look at also, Australia began as a citizen diplomat venture in the beginning. In the beginning, there was a great deal of goodwill among both the Israelis and Palestinians. But when the process shifted to White House, and then ended up being controlled by state actors, you see the peace process in the Middle East almost collapsing now. But like I said, some governments like Macedonia has welcomed it openly, other parts of the Balkan as well. So it's a question of spreading awareness about this citizen diplomacy, and also it also involves civil society in societies in which there is conflict. They also take part in this, in diplomacy.
I wanted to give an example of what you're saying and how that process has been taken over. In India and Pakistan, there was an initiative called the PAK India People's Forum for Peace and Democracy. And this afternoon, actually, from 1:30 to 3:30, there's another panel on South Asia, where some of the people who were involved with this particular process are going to be speaking. What happened is very interesting, because it began by a very simple notion that each side demonizes the other, despite the fact that you have a common language, a common culture, you eat the same food, you wear the same kind of clothes, and yes, there is this line which divides people on each side, that if only people came to know each other, that they would think differently, that this demonization process would break down. And these were very important initiatives, because it began by people going to Lahore, then people from Pakistan coming to India, going to Calcutta, Delhi, Bangalore. These were the cities in India, and in Pakistan it was Lahore, Peshawar, Karachi, these cities. And you had different groups of people visiting. Part of the reason was that people wanted to, on both sides of the border, this was their first opportunity to go and visit their homeland, because you had people in India who really were originally from a city in Pakistan, and vice versa. Now, what happened to that initiative? You had Bajpai, who then decided that he will take a bus, went across the border and hugged Nawaz Sharif. It was a big ceremony with all the military, this thing at the Wagha border, strutting that goes on each time when the flag is raised and the flag is brought down. And essentially what happened, that those doors which had been open were shut down, because now it's almost impossible to get visas to go to visit the other country. And essentially the whole process was taken over by these political leaders. And exactly what happened with the initiative with respect to the Middle East, which ended up in really a complete derailment of the peace process.
I know that there's serious challenges, but what I hear now is that in Macedonia, for example, we can take it as a model. There are encouraging signs that citizen diplomacy is having a very positive impact on the
I'm not questioning that. I'm just saying that it's one has to be on guard.
That's very serious challenge.
I see you. I'm going to try next, and then you. I'm still trying to privilege people who haven't spoken yet. So then Anne, and then you.
Very small intervention.
Thank you. I'm glad I came late, so that by the time Marcia is back. one thing I have to say that, yes, we don't take any action. There's a lot of talk that doesn't result in action. That is really a problem. I mean, for example, very simply, like she said, there is nothing to argue about. This is how the political system works, and you have to know how to work it. Now, for example, I'm personally involved in the political system in a way. There is an MP right now in the House of Commons from Ontario who lied on his CV. He said he has an MA in economics from University of Toronto, but he doesn't. It's a very simple situation. Do we accept a fraudulent claim for degrees from our leaders? I would say no. Most of the Canadians will say no. But the guy is still there for the last 10 years. I am the single voice struggling against it. All the talk about doing this, that, and the other has not generated enough pressure to get him out. Now, it's a very simple political situation which needs action. All the talk here won't help. You have to write to your MP, you have to visit your MP, talk to them, whatever you have to do, you have to do. And get the guy out. I'm launched a complaint because of the circumstances. I launched a complaint to the Human Rights Commission, went through that, then it went to the federal court. Now I'm struggling without a lawyer in the federal court. No lawyer has volunteered. I've tried to find lawyers, but no lawyer has volunteered. But these are really, you know, I mean, it's a very clear case. The only thing that's, how should I say, saving the guy there is lack of political pressure. It's a black and white in the sense situation, and he should be kicked out, and at least nobody I talk to say that he should be saved, but nobody does anything either. They don't lift a finger, and that's the problem. So I think action is very important, and you can't get the results you want from your parliament if you allow such people to continue. That's the other side, because it undermines the very integrity of the house. So anyway, that's my little bit on that. I just want to say...
Can you be brief, because we only have 10 minutes, so I'm going to start asking people to limit their comments to about 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, okay. Just on a brief side, I do commend this lady for having that wonderful training. I also got some training way back, and I think it's a good training. But at the same time, I think militarism is definitely a problem, and it has to be approached. I don't know how long you can go. But anyway, one thing I do want to say, I think the question about how did the, the paternalism came to North America, I think in a very simple word, I would say it probably came with the ships from Europe with all the men on it, and they brought the paternalism there. That was it. I mean, there it was.
But how did it get to Europe was the question.
It started from there because they didn't take the woman on the ship, I guess.
No. I'm not going into the origin state. Right.
Ambrose Benning from Sudan, original. Just in passing, if we have to act along the lines in which he's trying to urge us to clear the House of Commons of all the frauds, I think we would have no parliament.
That's an exaggeration.
Oh yes, they've been lying to us about more important things than about degrees. Surely, we have to prioritize. What I have to say here really is me thinking aloud to myself about the experience between a friend from Iran and I found it very interesting, and I feel torn between them. And in some respects, they are both right. That women in the military are used as tools, but she feels that by training in the military and holding her gun, she felt women feel empowered. Both right, but. Empowered in which sense? Because when you're talking about power, you have to also find a role for yourself, for the person creating space within the structure. In the country I come from, I have two examples of women. One who became a commander in the main armed opposition group in the, from the Southern Sudan, which is leading the fight against the Islamic regime in Sudan. One fought in the first phase of the war, which lasted 17 years. And after an interview of 11 years, when the settlement was reached in Addis Ababa with the help of Emperor, late Emperor Haile Selassie, this woman found herself actually absorbed into the prison. She became a prison warden. A prison officer, despite the fact that she was actually in the front line of his life. And she was a very notable composer, songwriter, singer, very high reputation in the local area. But when peace came, she wasn't even part of the peace process. She just became another tool which was used by the men to fight that war. And then she was lucky to have been fitted in, otherwise she would have been pushed back to the kitchen or greet children. I met her in 73. By then she had been promoted to major in the prison services. then the second phase of the war, which continues now, has continued for the last 19 years. She, again, in 83, she joined the opposition group again and became a pretty senior commander in the rebel army. But the rebel army is composed of a political structure, you know, the hierarchy of the armed resistance. It has a political wing, a political high command, and a military high command, both combined in one person. The commander-in-chief of the rebel army is also the head of the highest political command. There's no woman there. She wasn't there. That means when you come down to actually participating in the peace process and actually having power, a powerful place where you can influence decisions, the woman is not there. So in that sense, she's a tool. She's also right in saying that, you know, she's also right in saying that, you know, the woman feels empowered. Again, I give an example of one woman who was forced into marriage by a military intelligence officer against her will. And when the second, that's the first phase of the war. In the second phase of the war, she joined the movement this time and held a client, as she said. But what does that example really say about the collective empowerment? You know, I mean, she had that exhilarating feeling of being able to defend her honor with her own gun. But what does that mean in collective terms, empowering women?
As it happens, Anne's next in the speaker's list, and then I'm going to allow Roxana to respond and then.
Small point. Very small.
Okay, after your words, we'll go to you, and then Marcia, you're the last speaker, and I think I'm going to cap the speaker's list, and we'll finish after that because it's about 25 past the left now.
I did want to continue on that theme. I wanted to talk about the question of citizen diplomacy and just mention, although it didn't go as far as we would like this type of initiative to go, but I just wanted to point out that there was a spontaneous manifestation of a type of citizen diplomacy during the OCA crisis here in Quebec, where there had been a very formal process of observers that were brought in from Europe to observe the situation, and the situation was so bad that the observers went back to Europe because they declared that they couldn't do their job. The situation was so bad, they were not being protected, etc., that they couldn't do their job. And what happened is that there was this spontaneous emergence of what became a citizens observers group. And the most important aspect of that is that 90% of this spontaneous emergence were women. There were women that we ended up, because I was part of that, first of all, it is women that established what became the peace camp down at the, it was women from a women's center that actually just spontaneously went down and asked what was needed and set up what was an observer's camp, which became a peace camp. So this is a powerful tool. It can at other levels become I'm thinking in French, récupéré by those in power. But one things are going on in order to maintain peace, and it is essential that citizens take this on, whether they're seen as legitimate or not. They need to be seen as legitimate by those that are being oppressed. They need to be seen as legitimate by, and we ended up having a certain legitimacy with the police and everything. They ended up having to respect us just because we were so many, and because we imposed ourselves, and because the United Church also got involved. We imposed ourselves as an authority, and we ended up going and testifying before the committee, the parliamentary committee afterwards and everything. So I think that citizen diplomacy and citizens' movements at that level are essential. They're essential right now with what's going on with the whole question of the detainees. It's something that NAC is lacking the resource right now, but it's one of the projects that we wanted to work on this year, was the whole question of a type of citizen diplomacy, a type of citizens observers group that mobilizes citizens, because it is when citizens are mobilized around very specific issues that aren't drowned out, is Marcia's criticism of you know, there being so many issues on the table that eventually you can't deal with them. But I think a citizen diplomacy is something that we haven't explored enough, and that it is a way for women. It is something that really corresponds to the way that women function within crisis situations often.
Well, I think a few people have commented on what I said, maybe I should say a few more things. I think that if we look at violence against women throughout the world, this is a major issue. And being able to resist is perhaps provide some kind of solution. It's just one way. And I think that the problem is for me the same as, do you support, can you understand suicide bombing or do you condemn it? At some point, I think that I want to respond to Cherie that, yes, I think that Gandhi's way of passive resistance did work in India. It was very successful.
I didn't make that point, by the way.
No, you didn't, but you said that. But you said that using violence, nonviolent resistance, you criticized me for... No,
I didn't hear. I didn't say anything about non-violent resistance movement, because that is not something which I think there are different ways in which people have to respond. Anyway, I don't want to interrupt your this thing.
Yes, well, and that's if you mean to categorically say that any kind of women participation in getting military training or within the military is wrong, is problematic. There are situations that can be empowering. I mean, just women who can use guns, getting through military training and learning how to use guns will give them security. Certainly, it gives me a sense of security that if I was attacked by my husband or anybody in the family, I can defend myself. It's much more of a defense.
Thank you. Just moving on very quickly to.
Yeah, very quickly. Only I want to endorse what Shimura said.
She's next.
Okay, Marcia, very quickly.
No, you're after this gentleman.
No, very quickly, I want to endorse what Shimule said. I was born in Gaya in India and came to Pakistan. But what happened is that all the people, in spite of their peace-loving intention, the people don't have power. And the military, military junta in Pakistan and this fanatical group in India, they have the real power. And they are the people who really matter. So even if my good wishes are there as a Pakistani, and Shimule's good wishes are there as an Indian, originally Indian, it will not work, because the power structure built in both countries are such that it will just not work. That was the thing.
Okay, two things. Number one, I can't speak for other countries. I can only speak for Canada. And in Canada, women have all the power in the world, but they do not use it. So that's part of the problem. We'll need applause for that. We want to finish this damn thing off. So when women really learn how to participate within the political structure, they'll be able to use the power that they have and, you know, give it a little push into the United Nations to help other countries. That's number one. Number two, you want to know how to get rid of an MP? I'll see you after this. I'll tell you how to get rid of an MP.
I'd like to make a concluding.
Before Shree and Lillian sort of wrap this up, I'd just like to remind people that there are caucuses to continue these discussions, and they're posted on a bulletin board in the mezzanine, and that at 6:45 there will be people meeting on the mezzanine also to go to the panel tonight.
So we are going to wrap it up.
And then Lillian are going to speak for several minutes.
At 11:30 in room 460.
Four six zero.
I don't know. 460.
That kind of 460. Okay.
Sheree, you want to wrap?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate some of the ideas that have come out of this discussion today. One of them is to really consider the question of individual empowerment versus the empowerment of groups of people who have not shared power. And in that context, the comments which are the knowledge that Ruxana shared with us is important, but it balances with what the other powers are in terms of groups of people, how they within that context are able to exercise that particular power. The other thing which I want to emphasize is that militarism is more than armies, more than troops. It is a whole ideology, and that ideology is based on social, political, economic constructs. And that if we want to undertake what Lillian was talking about, which is an anti-imperialist struggle and anti-militaristic struggle, I see them not as separate but really linked very closely to one another, that we actually have to begin to dismantle the house of the master. That's it.
I just want to add a few things about the notion of action. Action takes many forms, and I think it is incumbent on us not to sneer at other people's notions of what action is. I don't believe in parliamentary means as the primary or exclusive means of action, but I know that things can happen within within parliamentary settings. However, it doesn't get to the economic base of society. I don't think that you can vote out capitalism. You can vote out certain forms of oppression, and that gives some breathing space. But I was part of a movement that brought down a president of the United States and ended a war, and it was not because the majority of the elected officials opposed that war at any point. There was a point when only one or two of them did. One senator voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964. By 1975, there were more members of Congress who opposed the war, but nothing like, nowhere like a majority. But the majority of the people did, and the people had other forms of action. And those things, like demonstrations, like peace camps, like the peace movement that sent people to North Vietnam to bring back political prisoners, that sort of thing, that sort of popular initiative was an essential extra-parliamentary means. In many parts of the world, extra-parliamentary means, you know, is a euphemism for kind of direct action that goes beyond the kind of extra-parliamentary means that Roxana is talking about with the Kalashnikov. But the thing is that we cannot afford to dismiss either the parliamentary or the extra-parliamentary means as women. And to call only one of them action is a mistake. We all believe in taking action. I think we should go out and do it.
Thank you.